So, to get started, I'd like to ask our guests to introduce themselves and describe what kind of practice each of you is involved in.
Hello, UCSD students. My name is Katie Bueller. I am a licensed midwife, and that's a state recognized license, Medical Board of California. And I'm also a certified professional midwife, which is a nationally recognized certification for midwives who are trained to practice out of hospital, essentially, trained to be safe in a setting that's either a birth center or a home. Although technically we could work in any setting, including a hospital, our licenses generally are used for people who want to do birth not in a hospital. So we call that a community setting. A birth center or a home is a community setting, and that's what I'm licensed to provide full well person, well woman type care, PAPS, maternity care, and teen reproductive care, and even into menopause.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks.
My name is Arena Angelucci. I am a certified nurse midwife, so a little different designation from Katie. I can work in any setting, home, birth center, or hospital. I am under the Board of Registered Nursing, so different from Katie, who's mainly under the medical board. And currently, I work at Best Start Birth Center here in San Diego.
All right. Well, fantastic. And thanks to both of you for joining and welcome. I thought that maybe we could start by asking simply what it means to be a midwife and how this is different from the type of care that many people might be more used to under a physician or an OBGYN.
Well, midwifery care, mainly we are only with low risk women. So I would say that's one of the main differences between us and other practices related to OBGYN. And then also within our scope of practice, there are differences. I would say in general, both of us kind of take a more holistic approach, kind of looking at the woman as a whole. So not treating her as something that we have to treat a symptom, but treating the entire person. As Katie was saying, our scope of practice, both of us, we can do well woman, so not just OBGYN care. I think a lot of times when people hear midwife, they assume it's only prenatal care, only deliveries, only postpartum. But we can do contraception, we can do well woman, we can do into menopause. And so I would say that's one of the main differences is low risk versus high risk. So when it gets into a higher risk situation, which we have certain stipulations that we have to follow, we can either do co-care with a physician, or sometimes we have to transfer completely to physician care.
Yeah, and that's a really great distinction, Irina. I want to add that in other countries, it's like in most of the European countries, you would retain your midwife as you also retain that higher level of risk assessment and relating to this, relating to a higher risk situation. So the midwife continues to see you because you're receiving a sort of a compassionate and guiding care, while someone who's treating the symptoms also sees you from a medical perspective.
And so what, just to get clear, what are the types of, concretely, what are the types of services or care that a midwife provides, and how might that be different from a physician or OBGYN?
I think there's a lot of overlap. This is Katie. For sure, like both obstetricians and midwives provide, full maternity care. So prenatal visits, birth, postpartum, breastfeeding. So the clinical care overlaps completely. But what differentiates is that typically in a midwife visit, especially for prenatal care, we're talking about a longer visit, answering questions that parents may have about their body or their hormones, or their back is hurting, or they feel nauseous. What should I do? So we tend to take, like Irina was saying, a more holistic approach to the whole person. What am I going to do? I have a 2-year-old at home. How is this going to go? We're trying to help them organize for that, in addition to looking after their blood pressure and is the baby growing properly and taking their blood work and things like that.
Okay, great. That's super helpful. So I mean, kind of related to that first question is the question of, you know, why people or perhaps who is it that chooses to see a midwife rather than, you know, a doctor or a physician for their care? So is there a difference in the type of clients that you serve? And what, you know, what are the types of, the main types of reasons that people choose a midwife?
This is Arena. I would say we kind of get everybody from all walks of life. I don't think there's one stereotypical kind of person that, you know, oh, they're seeing a midwife. We can get people who are super granola, as they say, all the way to people who kind of want more medical interventions. And, you know, various insurances come to us, various ethnicities, various ages. I don't know if there's one kind of pinpointed person. Some of the reasons when I ask, you know, what brought you to me or what brought you to the birth center, a lot of times it's maybe wanting to have more natural approaches to things. So if they do have back pain, instead of going straight to this is a medical treatment or this is medication that you can take, these are some more natural things. So trying various stretching or trying chiropractic care. So kind of bringing in a whole wellness approach to care. Some other reasons might be that unfortunately they maybe didn't have the best experience with their previous birth. And so they're looking for something different, maybe something less interventive, maybe something that's a little bit more natural. But overall, I don't think we can kind of pinpoint and say that there's one kind of client. There's just a variety of different people that come, which is great because we are available for everybody.
Yeah, I love what you just said, Arena. That's so true. Really, all kinds of people come to us. The only thing I would add is that it seems to me that people who come to us, I've been trying to quantify it, Arena. Seriously, I've been trying to figure out what it is. It's not, are they LGBTQ? Do they make more than $50,000 a year? Like, what is it? And the only thing I could pin it down to is that they believe in themselves. Mm. The people who come to me believe that they can do it. And I just love that. I love the idea that people who feel empowered come to us and say, you know, support me because I know I can do this.
So a kind of follow-up question to that is, you mentioned earlier that in some countries or even within some clinics, there's some kind of collaboration between a midwife and other types of medical care. For example, in my case, my partner and I chose to do a birth at a medical center under the care of a midwife and a doula, which maybe we can talk about in a moment. But in our case, we required additional care from a physician. So I wonder if you could speak to that and, you know, the different roles that midwives can play.
Well, at Best Start Birth Center, this is Arena again, I can say that we do have various hospital practices who we consult with. And so one of the other big differences between me and Katie's licenses is the supervisory language that's for our scope of practice in the state of California. So Katie does not have to be supervised by a physician, whereas at this point in time, certified nurse midwives still have to be supervised by physicians. We're one of, I think, three remaining states that still has that language, which we're trying to get removed again. but when it comes to collaborating with people, we collaborate with physicians who have kind of a like-mindedness when it comes to birth. And so if something goes wrong, which unfortunately, I think it's on average, maybe about 10 to 13% of births intrapartum, meaning during the labor process, something could go wrong, where it's usually non-emergent at that stage. And so what we do is we call the hospital, give report, or we call the physician and give report, letting him know, you know, this is the situation. I have a client, this is what's now happening. And I think we need to be in the hospital. And then it's a seamless transfer, where we're able to then go direct into a labor and delivery room. We don't have to pass by the emergency department or triage. The nurse already knows we're coming, has gotten report, usually at that point has their records, and then they're under their care. So it doesn't always happen that way. Unfortunately, in some places, there are still some instances where there is a little bit of tension between community births, so in a home birth or birth center versus hospital birth. But, you know, working on that to educate, I think, is going to be a big process. But I think education is one of the main things that kind of helps with that. But a lot of times too, the midwife is able to go with and stay as a support person. But that doesn't always happen, just depending on the practice. At some practices, you meet that physician beforehand. So that way that person, if they need to go to see them, if they become high risk, they're already associated with that physician. So it's not just showing up and seeing some brand new face. They're able to kind of have that relationship beforehand. So again, it's continuity of care versus just kind of dropping them off and saying, all right, well, good luck. See what happens.
Cool. Yeah, and I would just add that I think it's pretty similar to sort of dive into it a little bit between Irina's case and my case. So, but I don't have any direct agreements with any physicians. We have the same kind of transfer, but instead of, you know, having a particular physician that I can transfer into because I have an agreement with them, we just go to whichever hospital is closest or within the patient's insurance. And then we do basically the same thing. But there really is an advantage in Irina's case because what she can do is she can call that OB that they have a relationship with and say, I have a person here who has high blood pressure, or I have a person here whose baby is breech. Like, I'd like to get, you know, or more complicated things than those, and try to get a second opinion about something. Or for me, and because of the way the medical system is set up. And for those of your listeners who are actually interested, it's mostly, we, as we understand it, to do with, as Irina said, education and also insurance, liability insurance on the doctor's part. But I can't just call a physician and say, here's what's happening. Can I get your take? Can I get your opinion? Mm-hmm. That's a little bit more challenging from my end. So that means I have to send the client to the doctor, and then they have a conversation with a doctor about their condition, and then they can either come back to me or they can't. But Irina has, like she said, a more seamless arrangement, which is great for people.
So, you know, in this context, it maybe makes sense to ask what the different outcomes are like. So one concern that some listeners might have as well, is it actually safe to do a birth outside of the care of a physician? And are there different types of medical outcomes, or are there better or worse outcomes under the supervision of a midwife relative to a physician?
When we look at statistics, we have as a community midwife, we have a database of 15,000 prospective families who were choosing community birth and looked at their outcomes. And we got pretty much the same outcomes in terms of whether mom or baby were injured or died as the hospital. The numbers were almost exactly the same. But with our case, it had, you know, we have a 90% vaginal birth rate, and that is compared to a hospital vaginal birth rate of about 65%. So if you do the math, that's like, we have a 6 times higher vaginal birth rate than hospitals do. So to me, that's a sign that what we're doing is actually safer for people. We don't lose any more moms or babies. We don't have any more injuries, but we have better outcomes. And breastfeeding, which a lot of your listeners may know, is so important for our long-term gut health, long-term immunity, long-term bonding in a family. Breastfeeding rates for folks who had community birth were 95% at 6 months, which is just an outstanding number. And so that's another, you know, benefit to doing it with us as opposed to a hospital system where you're not getting necessarily the same level of support when things kind of go off the rails a little bit, as they often do.
Just to be clear, what's the alternative to a vaginal birth for those who don't know?
Oh, this is Katie, a C-section. So having a surgical birth, right now in this country, we have a one in three women has a surgical birth instead of a vaginal birth. And surgical birth is accompanied with, you know, potential problems in not only mortality, but also morbidity. So like a bladder that gets nicked, or scar tissue that develops that makes it harder to move around as you age in life. There's a lot more comorbidities associated with cesarean or C-section birth over vaginal birth.
So I realize that neither of you do that procedure, but just roughly what's involved in a C-section?
I can assist in C-section. So that's another difference between me and Katie's is if I work in the hospital, and when I was in the hospital, I can assist the physician in a cesarean. This is Arena. The gist of it is basically the woman is numbed from the waist down. So an epidural is one form of pain relief. And so the epidural is just dosed higher so they feel nothing. Another form of anesthesia, unfortunately, is at times they have to put a woman completely under, just like with any other surgical procedure. It just depends on how emergent the situation is. But normally they're brought back to the OR or the operating room. A drape is placed so they can't see anything pretty much from their neck down, just to keep everything sterile. It is major abdominal surgery, and so we do want to make sure that we're trying to decrease that risk of infection so everything is completely as sterile as possible. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but basically it's cutting into the lower abdomen, so they cut through the skin. And then we know that our abdominal muscles basically are two sheets that kind of come down your body. So it's opening that and then opening the uterus and then removing baby. And then usually baby is then given to a NICU team, depending on why the C-section is happening, just so that way the baby can be monitored. The uterus is then removed from the body and closed up that way so they can see what's happening. And then everything is placed back in and then stitched back up. I think a lot of times when people talk about C-sections, because it's almost become like a normal part of birth, people consider it to be kind of just like, she's going in for a C-section, and they don't understand or realize that it is major abdominal surgery. You know, you have to be monitored for days afterwards. You can't really move around well, which can then sometimes affect breastfeeding or bonding with baby because then you're in pain. But it's definitely, when needed, a life-saving procedure. I just think that sometimes there may be done a little too quickly.
Right. Yeah. That's a really important distinction. And it sounds like just the likelihood of a C-section is much greater if you begin in a medical setting relative to if you're beginning with the care of a midwife. So kind of related to that and different types of care, I don't know if we've mentioned this already, but some folks choose to give birth at home. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about what home birth is, and just more generally, whether it's at home or in a clinic. You know, you mentioned epidurals. Can folks who consult with a midwife access the same drugs as somebody who's under the care of a physician? So if you didn't think you were going to have unbearable pain, but you end up having more pain than you expected, is it still possible to access the same types of drugs under the care of a midwife? And yeah.
I think Katie's taking a phone right now because she's on call. So I'll talk a little bit about pain relief. I don't do home birth, so I'll let her kind of tackle that one. But when it comes to pain relief, we are only a low risk. And so when it comes to epidurals or IV pain relief, you won't really see those in any community settings. So you won't see those in birth centers. You won't see those in home births, mainly because you need to be monitored continuously with a lot of those. Also, when it comes to epidurals, an anesthesiologist has to place that. So we don't have anesthesiologists on staff. So for pain relief options, a lot of times it's positioning, it's breathing, water births or getting into the tub. So a lot of people call getting into a tub or water birth the midwife's epidural because it can greatly affect pain relief. One of the new toys that we just got at Best Start Birth Center actually is nitrous oxide, which is used in a lot of settings in Britain, for example. They use it a lot in England and some other countries. And so we now have that as an option for pain relief because it's fast acting, meaning it has a very short half-life. So basically once you're done inhaling and exhaling, once you remove it, it's out of your system pretty quickly. When it comes to nitrous oxide, it's a different amount than what you would get. So if you've ever been to the dentist and they give you nitrous oxide, it's less than that. So that's used for anesthesia. The amount that we used is used for pain relief. So for pain relief options, a lot of times, as I said, more natural things. Sometimes a combination like of Tylenol and Benadryl, but nothing that's going to really give you as much as IV pain relief or epidurals, which would be used in the hospital setting.
Right. So if you were, for example, at UCSD, if you were to give birth in the birthing center there, so that's kind of a medical environment, but you can give birth under the guidance or under the care of a midwife. Is that, so that's, is that considered a community birth or is that,
This is Arena again. That's actually kind of up for sometimes a heated debate in certain parts of the community birth world. Because it's in hospital, some people believe it shouldn't be considered a out of hospital or a birth center, and other people feel differently. When it comes to birthing there with midwives, from what I understand, you can get IV pain relief there because that is something that can be managed by a midwife. But epidurals would be given on a labor and delivery floor. So you would be moved from the birth center to a labor and delivery floor room to receive the epidural.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. That's super helpful. So we can maybe just pause for a second and let Katie finish her call so she doesn't feel like she has to rush and take a little pause. I'll just pause the recording.
There we go.
Okay, we're back. We just took a little break, but we were just talking offline about some of the stuff that's going on right now in our crazy, very, very crazy world. And so I wanted to ask both Katie and Arena what it's like to be a midwife right now. And if you're facing any kinds of special challenges in the context of the COVID-19 global crisis.
Now, Katie, you want to just tell us your fun story you just said?
Yeah, I had just heard from some midwives in my community that we can't get bags of IV fluids and we can't get certain medications and we can't get gloves. And so what's been happening the last few days is I've been getting like 2 calls a day from people who are interested in birthing out of hospital because they're afraid of the coronavirus in the hospital. And so I've been afraid to take any of those people on because, and I'll get into more of it, but because I wasn't sure if I had the supplies. And we had to take a break because I got a call from my supplier saying I could get the supplies that I would need to take more people on. So that was really exciting. Mm-hmm. But to be really honest, you know, I want to sound like a professional in this recording, and it's really important to me that people listening get that we are professionals, but also on a very personal level, like how am I going to protect myself and protect all the clients that I have while seeing any individual client who may be infected and their husbands or partners are still working? And so if they're still going out into the community, they might be bringing it back. And probably Arena feels something similar to what I'm about to say, which is that these folks have, you know, their intention when they come to us is that they have a family-based experience. Like the partner participates a lot. The kids participate in the care and in the birth. And so how am I going to navigate still including the family while also keeping people safe? It feels really unsure to me in a way that I'm not a scared kind of person. And it feels really like, how do I do this with integrity and keeping people safe as much as possible?
Right. So I think these are the questions that just, if people aren't asking these questions about their daily lives and their professions, they're probably not normal. And especially in the medical profession, this changes everything for everybody. And so it's a time of assessing. My brother owns a landscaping business and he has to negotiate, it's a low risk business, but do I continue? And what are the best practices? And how do I care for my clients? And how do I care for my, you know, my employees? And especially in the medical profession, you don't want to stop serving your clients, and you can't control their actions. So the question is, what are the options to you? And there aren't any answers, it sounds like, that are simple, right?
No. And I would say one of the differences too, between me and Katie's, works that kind of makes a difference is that I work in a birth center, so I work in one location. So we're able to control the environment a little bit more in the sense that now whenever time somebody walks in, we're saying, you know, wash your hands the second you walk in. If you're sick or if you're not feeling well, please call us and, you know, we'll reschedule your appointment. You know, for our exam rooms now, what we're doing is instead of just, you know, changing the paper between everybody, we're completely wiping down the rooms. And so I think we're able to maybe control it a little bit more in the sense that, you know, with our birth rooms too, we're able to go through and clean it to our standards versus Katie's going into other people's homes. So it's not like she can go in beforehand and say, okay, I'm going to disinfect your whole house because we're about to have a home birth. So I think that also kind of changes the logistics about the settings. This also kind of reminds me a little bit about, you know, with supplies when it comes, when there was that huge storm in, Puerto Rico, a lot of IV fluids actually come from that area. And so there was a huge shortage for a while. And a lot of times when there's a shortage, everything goes to hospitals because they're a much bigger place and they're, you know, serving sick people. And so when it kind of trickles down to us, sometimes it's harder for us to find supplies because everything is going there first. So when it does come to masks or to gloves or even something as easy as like toilet paper, where everybody apparently now is hoarding all of it, we're having a harder time finding these supplies, which can then affect our care because we're kind of considered low on that totem pole of needing to be supplied. So it's definitely making a difference. I just saw an email going around from different midwives of how to sew your own mask. So I think supplies are getting low enough for people. As Katie was saying, she doesn't know if she can take on more people because she doesn't have supplies. So I think that's another scary part is just, you know, not having supplies, making sure everything is being cleaned, worrying about kind of that family-centered care. In a lot of hospital practices now, they're limiting the number of people that they're allowing a woman to bring with them. So as of now, which I know a lot of practices, they're allowing one person. So if a client has, you know, their partner and then a doula, which I think we said we're going to talk about, but another support person, a lot of people are now having to figure out, okay, well, now what do I do? I can really obviously want my partner to be there, but I want my support person there too. And then a lot of doulas are then having to figure out, okay, well now how do I figure out payment for this? Because normally payments include, you know, the support for pregnancy, the support when they're at home, if they're going to a birth center or if they're going to a hospital. And then of course the support for when they go to the different location and then postpartum care. But now it's, all right, well, if I'm not allowed to go with you to the hospital, how does that affect my finances? How do I charge you what I'm supposed to be charging you? So I think a lot of that is just kind of changing a lot of different aspects of care all around when it comes to every aspect of a birthing woman support team.
Yeah, and I think as Katie mentioned, so all of these are problems that you're facing as midwives, but the problem of containment is even more important in the context of a hospital setting where not only are there just many more people interacting with the same surfaces and the same environment, but also the reason that people are consulting at hospitals may involve treatment for exactly this virus, right? Whereas your clients generally aren't consulting for anything other than giving birth. So no, that's really interesting. I have a friend who is a midwife and she's also really scared by this as everyone is and has two teenage daughters who are staying at home, but whose friends are out partying. And you know,
oh, wow.
And so this is one thing that I think is really important for folks to understand is that there's this perception in the community that younger people aren't at risk for this virus, which is of course false. Everyone is at risk. It's just that older people are at a greater risk. But also the risk is transmissible. So if younger people are out there spreading around this virus in the community, it places healthcare workers at risk. And it places, you know, our relatives at risk for, you know, everyone who knows people who are at slightly greater risk, but especially healthcare workers because you're in frequent contact. So it's not just getting exposed once that places someone at risk, but actually the dose, right? So the amount of virus that you're exposed to can impact the likelihood of getting severely ill as well. So I think that's an important point to highlight too, that the activities of people who feel relatively invulnerable to this kind of sickness can still impact people like yourselves who are in frequent contact with the community.
Yeah, I just heard a WHO, maybe you guys have too, a WHO produced presentation. And it turns out that on the Diamond cruise ship where they were actually testing people, only 40% of the people who had symptoms developed significant infection. Did I say that right? 40% of the people who were carrying the virus actually developed symptoms. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that, you know, all those people who think that they don't have it and therefore they could be out on the beach or out hanging out with friends, 60% of people will not show symptoms, which means that they could still transmit it, as you're saying, David, to those other people who we don't know what individuals' susceptibilities are.
That's right. So, and that's exactly right. Same for children. So some folks have heard that children can't get sick from this, but that doesn't mean that they can't transmit the disease.
Right.
South Korea has really great numbers because they're blanket testing the population. They're not just testing people who are sick. And they've found huge numbers of infected individuals in the 20 to 30 range. So there's evidence that these folks between 20 and 30 who aren't necessarily getting severely ill are probably playing an outsized role in transmission because they're much more likely to be socially interacting, to feel less vulnerable to the disease, and so to interact even more and to propagate it throughout the community. So there is a really important role for relatively healthy young people to play in protecting others in the community. I don't want to end on Armageddon. So what I wanted to ask you next before we wrap up, because I know I was mentioning to you in our break that every year when we do the midwife panel in this class, there are at least a couple folks in the class who decide in that moment that they want to become midwives, that this is a really important experience for them. And so I wanted to ask you each how you became midwives, what your training path was, and how you got to be a midwife, and also what students should do if they decide they want to become involved. What would their next steps be?
Yeah, I love that question. This is Katie. That's actually how I became a midwife, was a midwife and a doula came to my UC Berkeley College class, and I discovered that that was a possibility and rerouted my whole life so I could do this. What we haven't touched on, you guys, I just realized, is like the reason anybody would want to be a midwife is because it's so joyful. It's such an incredible opportunity to, right, Arena, to be with people in like this moment, the families and the people who are pregnant and the babies. And I mean, it's just this incredible transformation in a person's life, and to get to take part in that and put on your superhero cape and make sure that they're taken care of. Like, it's an amazing thing to get to do. I've been doing it for 10 years and I am looking forward to the next 30, you know? But to answer the question specifically, the way I trained was that there is a school in San Diego called Nijoni Institute of Midwifery. It's to prepare for community birth. In other words, a different license type than what Arena has. And you really want to look into the pros and cons of each, because right now I'm an independent business owner, which means I have to, you know, drum up business. People have to find me. I have to do all of the bookkeeping on my own. Everything is, it's like being an entrepreneur and a midwife at the same time. And also I love it that way. It's how I want to do it. But you can go to Nijoni. And then in my case, I also did a 3-year apprenticeship with a local midwife to learn how you do out of hospital birth. So you get the didactic at school and then you get the hands-on in a midwife practice, and voila, you take a test. And if you pass, you become a midwife. Mm-hmm.
Arena here. So certified nurse midwife is a little bit different, but a lot of similarities. And so certified nurse midwife is similar to a nurse practitioner. So it is a master's in nursing. And so before you get a master's in nursing, you have to have a bachelor's in nursing. So there's a couple of different routes that you can do. So the first route is you get your bachelor's in nursing. You work as a nurse for a little bit because most practices or most schools won't take you unless you have some experience. And then you go back to school to get your master's, which can take 1 to 2 years. The other route, which is the route that I did because I knew I didn't want to be a nurse, I knew I wanted to be a midwife, was I did a direct entry program. So I did a program that basically gives you your bachelor's of nursing in a year because it's a second bachelor's. So I already had a bachelor's in something else. I got my bachelor's in nursing in a year, and then you have to take the NCLEX, which is the nursing boards, to get your to become a registered nurse, and then you immediately start your master's program. And then in the master's program, we do didactic and clinical at the same time. So for your first semester, it's just all didactic, so learning about the different aspects of care. And then throughout the program, you're basically in clinic while you're also learning. So I went through two different practices, but most people are only at one practice. It just kind of depends on the program. So you're learning with your midwife while you're learning in school. And then when I graduated, I took boards, just like Katie did. And then I have to renew technically now two licenses. So I have to renew my midwifery license through the Board of Nursing. And then I have to also do my nursing license. So that's something that's a little bit different, is I have to do CEUs for those. They can be combined, so I don't have to do separate CEUs for either of them. But one of the other differences, which is nice, is, you know, most of the practices where I work, I can focus on my clinical aspect, which I liked a little bit more. So, you know, I don't have to worry too much about where my gloves are coming from, like poor Katie has to. You know, we have a biller that does our billing. We have somebody who focuses on supplies, so I can focus mainly on the clinical aspect of my job, which I love. So I would say that's kind of the two main differences. And then I guess where to get started, it just depends on which kind of midwife you think you want to be. So if this is Arena again, so if you're thinking you want to work in a hospital, then I would say probably a certified nurse midwife would be the route. If you want to work in an out of hospital setting, it's really, you know, depending on kind of which route you want to go. Do you want to focus more on kind of holistic approaches? I would say when I first started working with CPMs and LMs, I realized how different our schooling was, in the sense of, you know, we were focusing more on medical aspects. So, you know, we had a lot of classes about pharmacology because I can prescribe medications versus Katie cannot with hers. And then they had big classes about, you know, herbs that you can take and homeopathics and more kind of natural aspects of care, which I didn't have as much, which I'm learning more about now and love. So that's, I think, a main difference to kind of focus on. Usually I tell people where to start is to become a doula, which is, you know, that support person, which we've touched on, which I think you'll probably learn more about. But a lot of times that way you can really focus and find out if this is something that you want to do. You know, there are long hours. There are times where I tell people, oh, it all depends if I called in or not. You know, like, hey, should we go to the movies? Should we go to the brunch or do the things? It's, well, I might be working that day. So I think that's also another aspect of, you know, whether this is the job for you. But as Katie was saying, it is super rewarding. I mean, it's amazing just being with the family in that fantastic part of, you know, their life, of just welcoming in that new child and welcoming in a new member of their family. It's just an experience that's just, it's amazing, no matter what setting you're in. I wouldn't say one setting is better than the other always. You know, I think sometimes we get so focused on, oh, you know, epidurals are bad or C-sections are bad. I think everything has a time and place. So a lot of times I think it just kind of depends on where you want to be, who you want to work with, what kind of practice you want to work with, what kind of population you want to work with. Do you want to work internationally? A lot of that will be dependent on where you want to go. But usually I would say first step is just kind of getting to know the community, getting to know the midwives. You know, with coronavirus, obviously we won't be having meetings, but normally every 2 months, the certified nurse midwives have a meeting, and, you know, people are always welcome to come to learn more about midwifery. So that's definitely a place to go to as well. Or just, you know, finding midwives in the community and talking to them. A lot of times you can shadow a midwife, you know, like you can in some other practices, just because it is such an intimate thing to be in. So you know what, one of my boss always says, which I love, is birth is not a spectator sport. So, you know, we don't want just people sitting there and watching. But yeah, definitely start by looking at the community, maybe becoming a doula, and then kind of building from there. And definitely, you know, questions, I know, I'm sure I can talk about with Katie this, if, you know, if you have any questions, you can contact either one of us.
Fantastic.
We can answer more.
Yeah, so that would be wonderful. Sometimes in this class, I share the email contacts of folks who visit. So if you're open to that, I can offer to share your contact information with students of this class if they have any additional questions. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Nijoni, the school I was talking about, you can go down and Irina's right. It's hard to get to shadow a birth, but you could go down and shadow the midwifery school there for a day and just see if it feels like the right thing for you.
Fantastic.
It's really cool. Thank you so much, David, for inviting us to do this and making sure that all you guys listening have the access to this little bit of, American, you know, options, because I feel like we're not very well known. Not that many people understand what we do. So it's really a great opportunity to get to sort of virtually meet all you and have you know that you can have your babies with us. You can come get paps with us. And we're real friendly. And, you know, we love taking care of people. So thanks for the opportunity.
Well, no, I mean, you know, on the, I just want to thank you as well. This is amazing. And especially in this crazy time, it's just amazing that both of you could carve out an hour to talk to me in the first week of a global pandemic while you're also taking care, literally while we're talking, taking care of your patients and their needs. So I really, really deeply appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. This is great. This was fun.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.